Hello and welcome to Should I Love This Comic? My name is Damien Drury-Whiter, and with me today, as always, I have...
Irrigail Drury-Whiter.
And we are here to discuss another comic in Should I Love This Comic. Okay, we're on another episode of Should I Love This Era, where we're looking, instead of just looking at a comic I like, we're looking at a comic I like from the 25th anniversary of Marvel Comics. So it's the ones cover dated November 1986, and today we're looking at X Factor number 10.
We are.
Which is yet another special anniversary cover. So what we're going to do is start with what I've been doing in the episode so far in this series is I've been beginning with a kind of behind the scenes revelation about the goings on at Marvel in 1986. So we've talked about lots of other things that were going on. This time I'm going to actually go back to 1980. And the events behind X-Men 135 to 137, which is by Chris Claremont, John Byrne, and Terry Austin. Now, that may seem like an odd thing to do.
Why would that be?
Well, this comic isn't by any of those three people.
Oh.
And it's not from 1980. But actually, what happens in those stories sets up the launch of X-Factor 6 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So way back in X-Men 101, Jean Grey, who was also known as Marvel Girl, had seemingly died saving the X-Men as they re-entered the atmosphere on a damaged space shuttle. She used her powers to crash the shuttle into New York's Jamaica Bay, but Jean was reborn as Phoenix, a much more powerful iteration of her previous Marvel Girl persona. Over the next 3 years, we saw Jean struggle to cope with her new power levels, which gave her cosmic level powers. At the same time, she was being manipulated by the villain Mastermind into joining the evil Hellfire Club. In X-Men 134, she breaks free of Mastermind's conditioning and rescues the X-Men from the Hellfire Club. But she also announces that she has become Dark Phoenix and makes the X-Men's plane explode. In X-Men 135, consumed by her lust for power, she flies off into space and drains the energy from a star. We see that the star is surrounded by 11 planets, all of which are destroyed, including a planet inhabited by aliens who had appeared in an early issue of Fantastic Four. Then in the following issue, she returns to Earth, and she's consumed with bloodlust and fights the X-Men. Through a combination of the Beast technology and Professor X's telepathy, they're able to reassert Jean's original personality just in time to be teleported into space by the Shi'ar space race who want to put Jean on trial. Then we have X-Men 137, which sees the X-Men fight the Imperial Guard in order to decide who will determine Jean's future. But midway through the fight, the Dark Phoenix personality returns. The intention was for the X-Men and the Imperial Guard to defeat Jean, at which point the Shi'ar telepaths would remove the Phoenix powers from her, and she would return to Earth powerless. Now, at this point, Jim Shooter got involved. So we've been talking a lot in these kind of episodes about how Jim Shooter was changing storylines. And here we're talking about a storyline that he changed back in 1980. So Jean Grey, who's known as Marvel Girl, had accidentally become a villain because she'd been kind of powered up. And he gets involved and changes the story. For him, the destruction of the star in X-Men 135 was a genocide that couldn't be ignored. Jean had become a villain, and therefore she had to be punished. So a big part, actually, of the Comics Code Authority, which you'll notice has their little mark on... No, it doesn't, because I've got a UK edition. On American comics, they always have the Comics Code Authority mark on them.
Uh-huh.
At least they did back in the 80s, is that villains always had to be punished for being villains.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a thing they were held to. And because she was a villain, he felt she should be punished. So the ending of X-Men 137 was actually changed. And what happened instead of her being defeated and depowered, she died.
Mm-hmm.
Now this was a huge deal in comics fandom. The death of Phoenix became a milestone issue, and the behind-the-scenes manoeuvres became the stuff of legend. So lots of comics fans sitting around with their friends had heard about this storyline and knew it was because of Jim Shooter that they changed the story. Now, at some point, a group of fans got together to discuss how Jean could come back, considering that they knew that Shooter wouldn't allow her to come back without being punished for killing a solar system.
Mm.
Now, a young fan called Kurt Busiek had the idea that the real Jean had been replaced by Phoenix after the crash and was still in suspended animation in Jamaica Bay. So there was a crash into Jamaica Bay, Phoenix comes out, but that's not Jean, that's the replacement. Therefore, Jean hadn't killed anybody because it was the Phoenix who did the killing. Kurt Busiek was an aspiring writer and would attend comics conventions and happened to mention this theory to a comics writer called Roger Stern. And later on in this series that we're doing, Should I Love This Era, we'll come across an issue of Avengers that's written by Roger Stern. He's actually a writer from the Dime.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he mentioned it to other creators, which is how Jean was able to return for X-Factor number one when they sought to bring back the original X-Men. So I discussed in the last episode when we talked about X-Factor that there was this big fuss about bringing all the original X-Men back together.
Mm.
And they brought back Jean Grey and they brought Cyclops in, and it was against the will of the writer of X-Men.
Uh-huh.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And that happened. So I talked about that. These were the catalysts, these were key catalysts for the downfall of Jim Shooter. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to look back on how the death of Jean Grey was a key example of his edicts improving a story and helping creators improve the books. So in 1980, Jim Shooter comes in and says, no, she can't survive.
Mm-hmm.
So they kill her off. She has to be punished because she's a villain. Uh-huh. So they kill her off. But then Jim Shooter in late 1985, when X Factor launches, is then the one who's set bringing her back against the wishes of the people who he made kill her.
Mm.
So I think that's quite interesting that he's doing both of those. So I think it shows, we were talking, particularly I think in the first couple of episodes of Should I Love This Era, about how he was interfering and it was winding people up.
Uh-huh.
The interfering wasn't always a bad thing. It's what you'd expect an editor to do.
Mm.
But I think the issue as you get further into the 80s is it becomes about his ego being so big that he's always right.
Mm.
And he's not listening to other people or suggesting things.
Right.
And again, with the Jean Grey thing, he said, well, she has to be punished. And they went, well, we don't want to punish her, we're going to kill her.
Yeah.
You know, so he let the writers do what they wanted, but there were certain rules.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, it did change. So, X-Factor number 10, we actually see that Louise Simonson is dealing with the fallout of the launch of X-Factor. So, when we look mm-hmm. at this book, she's just taken over with issue 6, taken over from Bob Layton.
Mm-hmm.
Lots had gone on that, like, other people in Marvel didn't like, that in particular the X-Men writer Chris mm-hmm. Claremont and the X-Men editor Ann Nocenti. Now, Louise Simonson, who wrote this, was the X-Men editor before that. So she's looking back at Jean Grey and looking at all the things that happened at the beginning of X-Factor. So they're talking about the fact that Cyclops had left his son and wife to go and join X-Factor,
mm-hmm.
which was something that they did in the story that Chris Claremont was very angry about.
Mm-hmm.
And then within the story, the fact that the whole team of X-Factor, all of them knew that Cyclops had got married while she was supposedly dead.
Mm.
Nobody told her.
Mm.
Which obviously is insane. These are meant to be the oldest group of friends.
Yeah.
And for like 6 issues, they didn't think to mention to her, by the way, the man who you're in love with is married and has a child.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. So Louise Simonson was working on fixing this nonsense, but she does it in the most melodramatic means possible. So that's what we see as we come into X-Factor number 10.
Uh-huh.
She's been on the book since number 6, and she's gone, well, this is all ridiculous. The storyline is ridiculous. They're pretending to be mutant hunters because that's going to help them find mutants.
Mm.
But actually, that will just make people hate mutants more. And
yeah.
We talked a lot in the last episode about the whole starting philosophy of the X-Factor comic book didn't really work within the universe.
Mm.
And Louise Simonson takes that and just puts melodrama upon melodrama.
Mm.
And she's very much from that that group of writers of the time who melodrama was huge, soap operatics are huge.
Mm.
Now, I think this is going to be interesting for us to review because that makes it, if soap opera is huge,
mm-hmm.
it can be more difficult to get into.
Yeah.
You know, if you watch an episode of EastEnders, one of the most popular soaps in Britain, and you've not watched one in 10 years, you're like, who's that? Why are they doing that? You know, even if you know one or two of the characters, you're like, oh, what's going on now?
Yeah.
Because they may now be enemies with somebody who used to be their best friend, or, you know, it's quite often a bit of a shocking situation. So we are going to look at X Factor number 10. Mm-hmm. It is called Falling Angel. We had a story we did before about Angel falling, didn't we?
We did. In the very beginning.
In a Marvel fanfare. I think that was episode 2. It's written by Louise Simonson. It's penciled by Walter Simonson. I was going to say no relation, but they're married.
Are they?
Yes, a bit like us.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Well, not like us, because they've been married since the 70s and we were children. Inked by Bob Wycheck. Lettered by Joe Rosen. Coloured by Petra Scottese. And edited by Bob Harris. So let's start. And what has happened at the beginning of this story is that the mutant massacre has begun. The Marauders are tearing through the Morlock tunnels, killing every mutant that they can find. The X-Factor team are also in the tunnels. They'd rescued Rusty Collins from Freedom Force, but not before he'd been beaten unconscious. So the team have to split up. Marvel Girl and Angel will take Rusty back to the X-Factor HQ with his new friend Skids, while Cyclops, Beast and Iceman will continue to search the tunnels for Artie Maddox, who had gone off in search of Rusty and is missing. Marvel Girl is very worried about Cyclops. They had fought and he had taken his bad mood out on Rusty, so therefore he's blaming himself for Rusty getting caught by Freedom Force. Cyclops, Beast and Iceman run into two of the Marauders, Arclight and Harpoon, and they interrupt their killing spree. X-Factor are too strong as opponents, so Arclight brings down the ceiling to create a barrier between the Marauders and X-Factor. As Marvel Girl and Angel get back to HQ, Skid says how she saw them on TV fighting X-Factor. Skid sees X-Factor as villains who have increased anti-mutant hysteria. When Angel calls Cameron Hodge to get a doctor for Rusty, Skid immediately recognises him as a part of X-Factor and tries to get away. Angel explains that X-Factor pretended to be mutant hunters in order to rescue mutants, but Skid isn't happy. She's not happy.
No.
Back in the tunnels, we catch up with Artie Maddox. So Artie has teamed up with two Morlocks, Leech and Caliban. Leech has the power to remove people's powers, so Caliban has to move away. As he gets away from the kids, he gets pounced on by Sabretooth. Leech gets Artie to hide with him in a hole, but that means he misses X-Factor, who stops Sabretooth. X-Factor run off in the direction of more screaming as Sabretooth begins to come round to pursue Caliban and the kids. A lot going on, isn't there? We cut to the Pentagon, where Freedom Force are watching the news. They had leaked that X-Factor are being funded by the millionaire mutant playboy known as the Angel. At the same time, the news gets through to Angel's girlfriend, Candy Southern. She's the CEO of his company, and pauses a meeting to fly to New York to deal with the fallout. And back at X-Factor HQ, Angel and Marvel Girl are with Rusty and the Doctor, as Cameron Hodge tells them that Angel has been outed as the founder of X-Factor. So we go back to the tunnels, and another pair of Marauders, this time it's Vertigo working with Blockbuster, are attacking more of the Morlocks. Again, Cyclops, Beast and Iceman defeat them. By now, they have a small contingent of injured Morlocks to protect. So they're going through, they keep coming against Marauders. They defeat them and they take a few more Morlocks with them who they're going to protect. Elsewhere, Sabretooth has given up hunting Artie, Leech and Caliban. So Artie gets out of the pipe he was hiding in and runs off, so that his powers can work again and he can find X-Factor. because his powers wouldn't work when he was with Leech, who stopped powers. Back at the HQ, Angel and Marvel Girl discuss their angst. And literally, they just spend a page discussing how much they're all upset. There is a lot of it. As they comfort each other, Candy Southern arrives and she misinterprets the scene. She thinks they're having an affair and storms out. Jean realises she has to go back to the tunnels to rescue Cyclops because she's in love with him. An Angel goes with her. Back in the tunnels, Harpoon and Sabretooth try to attack the Morlock known as Plague. She reaches out and touches Sabretooth, who instantly collapses. Harpoon goes to attack but is stopped by Apocalypse, who has come to recruit Plague to become Pestilence, the first horseman of Apocalypse. Okay, so Arclight has arranged a search and destroy mission to kill X-Factor. Scramble and Prism are with her. Just then, Angel and Jean turn up and are able to help. Jean shatters Prism, but Iceman, Beast and Cyclops are all injured. They agree that they must separate. Marvel Girl will get the injured and the Morlocks they gathered back to the HQ, while Angel looks for Artie, who's still missing. He finds Artie really quickly, but they're soon found by three of the Marauders: Vertigo, Blockbuster, and Harpoon. Angel gets Artie to run away while he holds off the Marauders. Of course, he's in a small confined space, so his powers are useless. Blockbuster grabs him by his wings, and Harpoon pins him to the wall by his wings. He thinks about how he has failed as he loses consciousness. And then it says, to be continued, with things can only get worse. So what's notable there to me, as I was reading that, and as I was saying it, is I kept saying name after name after name after name.
Yeah.
And even I was getting confused.
Yeah.
And I first read this in 1986.
Yes.
And I've read it repeatedly over the years. Yeah. And I know who all these characters are.
Yeah.
So what we normally do when we review is we talk about a series of categories, don't we? And we score out of five.
Yeah.
So should we start doing that?
Yeah.
And the first one I wanted to talk about was accessibility. How easy was this to read as somebody who didn't know the book?
I think with the previous one, which I think we also did, where there were teams, sort of different kind of teams, that were pretending to be one thing and being another, and...
Well, that was X Factor.
Yeah, and so, you know, the Marauders and the... and the other people who live underground.
Morlocks.
The Morlocks. When I saw... I didn't know why the Morlocks lived underground. There was no explanation for that, which I don't suppose that really matters. You're kind of plunged in quite quickly without...
Yeah, I mean, it definitely starts in media res. Now, part of this might be my fault, because I've selected what order we're doing the Marvel comics of that month.
Right.
X-Men, which comes before, X-Men 211, which is in the same month, which we will eventually read, starts by introducing all the Morlocks. Morlocks, it starts by introducing all the Marauders.
Marauders.
The villains.
Okay.
But I didn't think you necessarily needed to read it in order.
Okay.
And I remember that I definitely read this one before I read X-Men.
Oh, okay.
So, again, I don't know if that helps or hinders.
Mm.
I think what you needed to know is the Morlocks live underground.
Mm.
Now, it does mention on the first page that they're outcasts.
Mm.
So that's why they live underground. Yeah. And I mean, I've heard other fans refer to them as being kind of... the Morlocks are kind of like the homeless within comics.
Okay.
You know, if you start talking about metaphors and stuff, they're like homeless
mutants. Yeah.
They're kind of the least powered ones.
Yeah.
And the Marauders are just a group of villains who are killing them.
Okay.
Now, part of the storyline of the Mutant Massacre, which I don't know if you get it from here, is you know that the Marauders are working for someone and are trying to kill all the Morlocks. You don't know why.
Okay.
And actually, you don't find out for about a year.
Okay.
You know, why they're killing the Morlocks.
Okay.
So it's just these guys turn up, just a group of villains turn up and start trying to kill everybody in the tunnels.
Yeah.
And lots of different superheroes interact with that. Mm. So
yeah.
Even as a fan at the time who'd read all the books, you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
But maybe if we'd read X-Men first, we'd know a bit.
Mm. Yeah.
I think it may have helped. My first issue of X-Factor was issue 9, so it's the issue before.
Mm.
And that is also based in these tunnels. They go looking for Rusty. Mm. And also that's where Artie goes looking for Rusty. So you know the little kid who's who you described as an alien when we were talking about it before.
Okay.
Goes in there and he's not an alien. But you kind of get, you know something's happening there and they become aware something's happening, but they don't know what it is in that story. But maybe having read that then means that the start of this story doesn't come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
One of the things that was very noticeable to me there was the number of characters. So I actually jotted down as I was doing like my notes for this issue a list of everybody who's introduced who has a name in the comic. And it came to 24 characters.
Yes.
And like three teams with 24 individual characters. And I just wanted to go through and see if you, what, if anything, you felt you learnt about any of them.
Okay, yeah.
So if we go through them in order, and I think this will help us come up with a score for accessibility.
Yeah.
So the first named person who gets mentioned is on the first page, and it's Erg.
Yeah.
And he's that guy there with the eye patch and the spiky hair. So he gets named. None of the other people on the first page get named, but he gets named.
Okay.
He's called Erg. Did you pick up anything about him?
I picked up a name. I didn't necessarily work out who he might be.
Now this is one where I had an advantage because I read Marvel UK before I learned, discovered Marvel US. Yeah. We've talked about that before.
Okay, yeah.
And Erg made his first appearance. He's like the first character there.
Oh, okay.
He made his first appearance in an issue of Power Pack,
mm-hmm.
which was reprinted in my Return of the Jedi comic.
Okay.
And was written by Louise Simonson, who wrote this story.
Mm.
So I knew he was, and he has electrical powers, but you wouldn't know that from the story.
No.
He's just a very odd-looking guy. So he's the first one, and he's one of the Morlocks, and there's loads of Morlocks. And I think once you hear that kind of comparison of them being like homeless people,
yeah,
you can kind of see that's what they're going for in a way.
Yeah.
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 I don't know, maybe not. So the next group is the Marauders who get mentioned. Mm. And there's lots of different Marauders, so let's go through them. Do you know who Arclight was? Did you pick up who Arclight was? Which one was Arclight? Could you tell me who any of those characters on that page are? There's three Marauders there. Oh, there's more than three, actually. But some of them are in shadow.
This is like spot the ball, isn't it?
Did you pick up which one was Arclight or what the powers were?
No.
Okay, so Arclight is the woman.
Okay.
They've all got asymmetric costumes, actually. She's the woman, and she's kind of got powers, and it's... I think it came down to... When I read the story, I thought it was just strength. But I think it's something to do with seismic, like, powers.
Yeah.
Because she's the one who makes the roof come down and she'll like hit the floor and it'll bounce. So I think that's what it is. Harpoon. You must have worked out who Harpoon was.
The American Indian one.
Which... No, Harpoon's actually Inuit.
Oh, okay.
And he's the one who throws harpoons at people. Okay. So that's easy.
Yeah.
We've got Scalp Hunter. Now, Scalp Hunter is nowadays known as Grey Crow and they never mention that name.
Okay.
For reasons. Do you know which one he was?
Say that again, sorry.
Scalp Hunter. Do you know which one was Scalp Hunter? Or Grey Crow, as they call him in 2021?
Was he the...
He's another one of the villains. He is the Native American character.
Okay.
He's kind of got gun parts on his costume, stuck to his costume.
Oh, okay.
And apparently he can build guns out of his costume. Although that's less obvious here than in another one.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go on to the next lot of characters who evolved. Angel. You know Angel.
Yep, we know Angel quite well.
You've read a story before. Yeah. We did a Marvel fanfare. He was also in The Amazing Spider-Man, so we know who he is. Marvel Girl, do you remember who she was?
No.
So she's Marvel Girl or Jean Grey. She's the one in the green and yellow costume with the red hair. And she can move things around with her mind. She's telekinetic. Skids. What did you get about Skids? Other than she's got a really stupid name.
Did she have a Mohican?
No. Skids is the one who's dressed a bit like Madonna.
Oh, okay.
Or early Madonna. And she's got a big red jumper and the tiger print leggings.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and like blonde hair to the side. Big earrings. Very 80s.
Yeah.
She's actually one of my favourite characters from this comic.
Oh, okay.
I think because of when I read it and the relationship between her and Rusty. Rusty is unconscious for this entire issue.
Okay.
But through the issues, it was something that I quite enjoyed reading the comic.
Yeah.
And she was a new character. She'd only made her first appearance a few issues before. So Rusty, we've mentioned, he's got fire powers, but you wouldn't know that there because he's unconscious. Oh, Skids, what she's got, a force field.
Oh, okay.
And apparently she can skid on it, so it's a bit like skating, but it's like friction-free force field.
Okay.
So she kind of skids everywhere.
Okay.
Cyclops, you know Cyclops, don't you?
One eye, I presume.
Well, he's the guy who fires beams out of his eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, from the X-Men. And then we had Iceman, you know Iceman.
Yeah, he's white and icy looking.
You know Beast? He was in the previous issue we read.
He's got a pointy head.
He has got, I mean, luckily he's wearing his costume here. The flat top they gave him in X Factor number, I think it's number 2 or 3 when they turned him back into human. That flat top is, every time you see him from this issue, it gets less and less. It was clearly something that was put into the comic, and Walter Simonson, who draws this issue, this is the first of a 3-year run.
Right.
And he comes on and just the flat top kind of gradually disappears and gets less flat toppy.
Right.
Because that's ridiculous. Cameron Hodge. Did you work out anything about Cameron Hodge?
No.
He appeared.
No.
So Cameron Hodge was their kind of business leader guy. And he was in the Spider-Man one, if you remember. They went and he went and told them all about Spider-Man.
Right, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And I said to you, he ends up being a villain, which I probably shouldn't have told you. But I think in this very story, he seems slightly villainous. He's going around telling people bad news all the time. Caliban. Did you know who Caliban was?
Shakespeare.
Yes, he's from Shakespeare, the name. But he's the white guy. The one who's actually white with the big yellow eyes.
Okay, why is he called
And he's Caliban? Got a sushi t-shirt on.
Okay, why are they called Caliban?
He's called Caliban because Chris Claremont likes naming people after things from Shakespeare.
Fair enough.
He was the first Morlock to appear.
Okay.
A long time before, back in the 70s he first appeared. Was it the 70s? No, it would have been the early 80s, I'm lying to you, about 81. He was the first Morlock. And what he did is, in his first appearance, he kidnapped Kitty Pryde, who's also known as Shadow Cat.
Uh-huh.
But at the time, her superhero name was Ariel.
Mm-hmm.
So Caliban kidnapped Ariel.
Mm-hmm.
Could that have suggested why they got the name?
Maybe.
Because Ariel's also from The Tempest.
Yeah.
So he's the white guy with the sushi t-shirt on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I said about there was a Power Pack story that I'd read with Ergin.
Yeah.
He got given that sushi t-shirt in that issue of Power Pack.
Mm-hmm.
It was a present from Shadow Cat when she'd been to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew all that reading this. And his power is that he can find other mutants.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Artie and Leech. So you've got the two kids. Pink kid, green kid.
Yeah.
What did you... It's very difficult to tell there because they're both pale blue on their first appearance on page 9.
Okay.
But you can see there, one's pink, one's green.
Yeah.
So, did you get anything about them?
That... They're getting... Or they're going into the tunnels with a taller man.
Yeah, that's Caliban. Caliban is trying to protect Leech.
Okay.
Because Leech and Caliban have been in stories before.
Okay.
Leech was presented, his first appearance in an X-Men story, he was presented as someone that all of the Morlocks tried to stay away from. He was a little kid, but because he stole people's powers, he takes powers away.
Okay.
So if he's near you, you can't use your powers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was really unpopular and kept away. Mm-hmm. Then they did stories, and the stories were all in Power Pack. They were all written by Louise Simonson, where he kind of gets adopted by another Morlock who's called Annalee. Mm-hmm. Now, Annalee is missing in this story. But if we'd read the X-Men story first, we would know she was dead.
Okay.
And if we were to read the Power Pack story that actually comes out the month later, Leech finds out she's dead, and it's heartbreaking.
Oh.
Because she's kind of become his adopted mother.
Okay.
So Leech has met, the previous issue, he met Artie. And Artie is the little pink kid. Now, Artie's dad was the person who turned the blue beast back into the human-looking beast.
Okay.
So you know he was blue and furry?
Yeah.
And now he's human?
Yeah.
Well, that was Artie's dad, who was a scientist, and he was trying to find a way to make Artie look normal because he looks weird.
Okay.
And he's got his little teddy bear all the time in his hand. Aww. He's got, like, a bumpy head. But, yeah, they're, like, the two little eternal Moppets of the Marvel Universe. They're adorable. People love Artie and Leech. I love Artie and Leech. Mm-hmm. And Artie's powers is that he can project images with his brain, but he can also kind of psychically attach to them. Mm-hmm. So later on, when he gets away from Leech, what happens is he brings up images of X Factor, and he can kind of follow them.
Right.
Because he can bring those images out, he can guess, he can kind of see in his mind's eye where they are.
Okay.
So he's following them. I'm trying to find the picture of that. When he gets away from Leech. Where is it? It might be much closer than I think it is. There you go. When he runs away, can you see he brings up an image of X Factor?
Okay.
And because he brings up that image, he now knows where they are.
Okay.
Yeah, which is a shame because Leech wants him to be his friend.
Yeah.
And they do end up being the best friends.
Okay.
And they're adorable. They are wonderful. Okay. Everybody loves Artie and
Leech. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Sabretooth.
No.
Do you know anything about Sabretooth?
No.
Okay, he's that guy, based on a Sabretooth tiger. He's an old villain that was introduced in the 70s. He was created by Chris Claremont and John Byrne. And initially, he was intended to be Wolverine's father. But by the time it was revealed who he wasn't okay. Wolverine's father. And he's, like, really, really vicious and mean and can beat anyone up and eats things and stuff. Really nasty character.
Uh-huh.
Kind of quite a typical one, you know, got claws, kills people.
Uh-huh.
And he just goes around hurting people for the entire storyline. Not much else to say, really. How about Candy Southern?
She was the woman who runs an organisation, and
She's the one who runs Warren Worthington's and the Angels company.
Yeah,
and she had been quite a big character in the past.
Mm-hmm.
She was his girlfriend going back to like 60s and 70s comics.
Okay,
and then in the 80s they did a series called Defenders.
Uh-huh.
Which Angel was on, and she actually becomes the leader of that group, even though she's not got any powers.
Uh-huh.
And she's leading a superhero group and telling them all what to do.
Yeah.
As well as being, so then they've moved her into this. This is actually towards the end of her story. We were talking about Candy Southern.
Yeah.
And that she'd been quite a big character in Marvel.
Yeah.
Now, she appears in this story, and then the next story she appears in, she dies. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
So she kind of disappears after this story,
mm-hmm.
quite weirdly, you know, after having been a major supporting character for a very long time.
Yeah.
And it's all part of the storyline is they're bringing down the Angel.
Okay.
That's part of what they're doing in this book. Okay, we did very briefly, I didn't write them down, but there's another group of characters at the top there called Freedom Force.
Yes.
And they are the people in the Pentagon, and they were the villains of the previous issue. And they're a group that used to be called the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants and have recently started working for the government.
Okay.
So they're trying to bring down X Factor, and they're the ones, as soon as they met X Factor, they're like, well, we recognise them. They're the X-Men, the old X-Men. And they're also calling themselves the X-Terminators. So they just contacted a reporter and said, look into Warren Worthington and X Factor. And it turns out, yes, it was his money that was funding it.
Okay.
So obviously, in a world where people are suspicious of mutants, the fact that a mutant is paying for X Factor, which is catching mutants, is very weird. You know, and it's kind of the beginning of the end of that storyline. The idea of them being mutant hunters is working its way out. It's kind of going away as we come in. So we've got a few more characters coming. The next page, I think, has Blockbuster. So Blockbuster is just a big guy. He's a big guy who beats people up. But he's, like, seriously massive, which I think you can kind of tell.
That's not Bob Holness, though, is it?
It's got nothing to do with Bob Holness, unfortunately. Americans won't know who Bob Holness is. Was James Bond. No, he's... He was James Bond. There was, in the 80s, there was a TV show called Blockbusters. Which was a quiz show for kids, I think, kind of university-age kids,
They seemed terribly grown up.
In the evening.
They seemed terribly grown up.
Yeah, to us, but we were quite young, weren't we?
Yeah.
I think they were probably at uni.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they used to go on, and it was a hardish.
Yeah,
probably won't be hard now, but when I was 11 and 12, it seemed very hard.
And what was the famous...
Can I have a pee, please, Bob? Go and Google it, you'll find out. Okay, so we got Blockbuster there. He's kind of an obvious character. He's the big, strong character who hits people.
Yeah.
He's a new character just appearing here. And we've got two of the Morlocks, who, again, you know I said some Morlocks had earlier appeared in a Power Pack story?
Yeah.
Two of them appear here, and they're called Tar Baby and Ape. I know, it's awkward, isn't it? Where did they go? We were looking at that page. We had a page open there, and it was the right page. Tar Baby and Ape he's fighting against. So they're those two. And can you see he kicks Tar Baby into Ape and he gets stuck to him? So I doubt you even picked up that they were named characters because they don't really have anything.
No.
But he does say, Ape, duck or you'll be stuck. And he says, I can't. So Tar Baby was sticky and he would stick to everybody like Tar does.
Yeah.
And then Ape is like a big ape thing.
Oh, okay.
And he could turn into anything. So he did things like he'd turn into a box and put things inside himself. It's a bit weird. Then we've got another villain called Vertigo. And can you guess what her powers are?
Balling.
Yeah, she makes people, like, so like he's all dizzy, feels sick, and then he falls over even though he's just on the ground. So yeah, there's Vertigo, that's another villain. Just really trying to give an idea of just how many characters are in this.
A lot.
By going through them. If we go over another page, we then get to Plague. Now, Plague was in the first Morlock story, and she's a character. She's an old lady, and actually you don't really see her face, just very briefly there. But the first story, she's drawn as a very, very old woman. And she literally touches people and they get sick. That's her power. But what's coming back here is Apocalypse. He comes to collect her. Now, Apocalypse first appeared in Louis Simonson's first issue of X-Factor, and he goes on to be a major X-Men villain. And we watched the film, didn't we? That he were, there was X-Men, was it called The Rise of Apocalypse or something? He was the villain, he was played by Oscar Isaac.
Okay.
But he was wearing a rubber mask, which was a shame when you've got Oscar Isaac. But anyway, yeah, he's a huge, major villain, and this is like one of his earliest appearances, and he says she's going to be the first horseman of Apocalypse. So he's taking a character called Plague and turning her into Pestilence. So he's kind of doing a revelation thing. Yeah, and that does happen over the next few issues. Each issue, he gets a different one. So this issue, he gets Pestilence.
Okay.
Next issue, I think, is War. Then the following issue is Famine, and then there's a lead up to him finding the Angel of Death.
So does he collect them?
He kind of gets mutants who already exist and slightly changes them. to make them into the Horsemen of Apocalypse.
That's where I got
them. And as we know, the last Horseman of Apocalypse is the Angel of Death.
Yeah. So.
Can you think of a character who might become the Angel of Death?
Angel, I would imagine.
Quite possibly, particularly as he's fearsomely injured in this storyline. So this is like the start of quite a long storyline that goes on.
Right.
And then just, we have two more characters that are in here. Mm-hmm. And these are very minor marauders who appear very briefly. There's Prism, who's the one who's like glass. But he actually gets killed off.
Oh.
He gets smashed. Although I must say, maybe it's just because of reading comics, I didn't realise that was meant to be him killed off there. When I read this as a kid.
Right.
He got smashed and there was a thing of him being pushed away and smashing and they run away.
Mm.
I didn't realise he was meant to be dead.
No.
I thought he was just injured or something. And there's also Scrambler. And Scrambler only gets to use his powers on one person. And it's literally, if he touches your powers, he messes up your powers. So it makes them go weird. So some people, it makes them go like wild and crazy. And, they, you know, if you were shooting energy blasts, suddenly you're shooting energy blasts at everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And with other people, like Beast is meant to be like an acrobat. Well, suddenly he loses ability to do acrobatics.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit like he suddenly turned into Simone Biles at the Olympics. He got the twisties.
Yeah.
So that's all the characters. So just going through that list, I think, shows anyone who's listening to this who hasn't read the comic just how many characters are in this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for this, we always talk about accessibility. I think this makes this story less accessible than many others we've read.
Yeah. Yeah, I think...
Now, that there is an attempt to explain who they all are as they go along.
Yeah.
But it's, I think it's too much for anyone's brain to take it all in, unless you're rereading.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how many of those characters do you think you took on?
Not many.
Yeah, it's just too much, isn't it?
I've only read it once, but yeah.
So, you know, it's quite weird for me because... You know, we've mentioned this is the era of comics I love. This is where I came in. X-Factor very quickly became my favourite comic. For a while, probably from here, from issue 10 up to about issue 35-ish, I would have called it my favourite comic.
Right.
All that way through. And I loved it. And I've read this and read it, reread it and reread it. And particularly when I first got it, I didn't have very many American comics. I only had... What, 10 comics?
Okay.
So I was rereading them in between. And that complicated thing was great fun because I was rereading it and rereading it and getting more out of it each time.
Yeah, as you were,
But now when I look at it, like trying to judge it objectively, it's kind of a weakness. What do you think? What would you score out of 5 for accessibility? Because we normally give a score out of 5.
Accessibility. 3, if I'm being generous.
3. I gave it a 3.5.
Okay.
Can't remember why I gave it a half. Maybe I was trying to be more generous. I mean, she does try to explain those things. And if you reread and reread and reread and look at the art again, you'll get it. And there's a lot of things. There's certain things in the art, which is what we discuss next. One of the things the colourist does a lot is because there's so many characters in a panel, she'll put a lot of them just in a monochrome. So a lot of the time it's blue, blues and purples.
Yeah.
She'll do monochrome and she'll just focus you on one or two characters to make it simpler for you to read it as a comic, that you can read the art. Because the art's really complex, lots of characters. But what that means as well is major characters are just in one colour in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't necessarily notice them unless you reread. And it's only once you reread that you know, oh look, on page 2, Sabretooth there in the background. But he's very minor. They're drawing your attention to Harpoon and the guy who he's attacking. By the way they've coloured it. So there's a lot going on there with the artwork that sometimes... makes you miss things that are there. I mean, some of it's the colouring, some of it as well is just, you know, the use of shadow there in the background. You're showing the relationship in both of those first two panels on page 4. You see the relationship between the splitting up teams of X-Factor going in different directions. But they only show one of the teams at a time. because it would be too complex otherwise.
Mm, mm.
But that can make it more confusing as well, make it less accessible.
Mm, mm.
I don't know, what do you think? What did you think for the artwork?
Not much.
Not much, as in you didn't think about it or you didn't like it?
I didn't think about it, really. I think there's that thing of a bear of little mind. I was concentrating on reading the bubbles more than looking at the artwork.
I mean, it's very wordy.
Yeah.
We talked in the last episode about how the fashion of the time was to be wordy.
Mm.
And Louis Simonson, I think, was quite a wordy writer anyway. Mm. In fact, I was quite surprised because recently Marvel released, and I mean, we're talking literally last couple of months, they've been doing this book called, I think it's called X-Men Legacy. And what they're doing is they're bringing old X-Men teams together, like writers and artists, and getting them to do a one or two issue story.
Mm.
And Louis Simonson and Walter Simonson did a two issue story.
Mm.
And there were very few words in it, and it was really confusing to me.
Oh, okay.
Because obviously, they're following the trends.
Yeah.
You know, she's been writing. I mean, this was 1986, was how many years ago? 35 years ago.
Gosh.
Oh my God, I'm old. Should we go away and cry for a bit while we think about that? But no, this was 35 years ago, and Louise Simonson has been a professional writer for those entire 35 years.
Mm.
Obviously, her work has changed to reflect fashion and also improved in some ways, you know, just through getting better at your job.
Mm, mm.
And I was quite surprised to read an X Factor story. It was published as X-Men, but it was these characters. It was actually set between two of the pre-existing issues of X Factor a bit later in the run. And there was a story by those creators, and it was so different to reading this. And coming back to this after having read that's by the same people is really odd. You know, that they're following that fashion so tightly. But I can see what you mean. The words almost make you not notice the art.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if you were to go back, if you look through it now,
yeah,
what's coming out to you? Because we've got to give it a score out of 5. Just the art. We're not looking at cover yet, because that's the next one.
Okay.
No, it's not. There's another one in between. I've got a list of things written down.
The bits I did like were the melodrama bits. Mm. I think, so both of us kind of, we watched both of the new Marvel films over the weekend, didn't we?
Yeah.
And we don't really like fights. And
no, fight scenes, definitely in movies for me, I find them very boring. I'd rather they were doing something with character that's interesting. You know, I do think the fight scenes in here, they're all quite interesting, but there's character stuff happening at the same time.
Yeah, I thought there was a character stuff where Thingy walks into
the whole thing with Candy Southern.
That's
really well done, I think.
That's quite gripping. I think also, sort of like, I think it's very, I think because there are at least three or four fight scenes, three possibly. And I kind of glaze over because I never really find comic book fight scenes very.
They're not my favourite part of the comic book. I think they're very clear what's happening in the scenes.
There are some very good.
And I think it's particularly good. Yeah, the facial expressions are very good.
Sometimes.
I think they're very good at showing the relationship between people in a space.
Okay.
I think you can see where they are in relation to each other.
Okay.
You know, quite well as people are moving around, and you get how, you know, it'll show the same thing from two different angles, and you can see how it's working.
Okay.
Or not working. And, you know, moving around a room and...
Okay, yeah.
I think that's very good. I mean, what score would you give the art out of 5?
3.
Okay. 3? Oh, you've been harsh.
I know.
I actually gave it a 5.
Okay.
Now, what I didn't tell you in advance...
Okay.
Last episode, I let the world know in advance that Rick Leonardi is my favourite comics artist.
You do.
Guess who my second favourite comic artist is?
Me.
No, it's Walter Simonson who drew this comic.
Not Mr. Bumble.
No, Mr. Bumble is an incredibly talented cat, but I haven't seen his artwork. I don't know if he can do panel-to-panel continuity. But no, as far as I'm concerned, Walter Simonson is a genius-level artist.
Probably quite poor.
I think his stuff is great.
Mm.
And I think maybe this isn't the best showing off of it. The story doesn't suit him as well as some stories do.
Uh-huh.
But I can't see anything wrong with the art in this book that's uh-huh. to do with him.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's got all the characters in there. They all look on model.
Uh-huh.
The emotions are true and real. He draws kids. He draws monsters. He draws,
uh-huh.
you know, superpowered cats. He's drawing different settings, different kinds of clothing.
Yeah.
And it all looks okay.
Okay.
And it's all just right. And I just think you've got to give a 5 out of 5 for that.
All right.
But... you know, you're allowed to have a different opinion, but he is one of my favourites.
Okay.
And he may come up again. We've followed him before because we did an issue of Thor that he wrote and drew the cover for.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did the cover for the issue of Daredevil. We did this.
Oh, right, yeah.
In this run.
Yeah.
And he will appear again because he does the cover and writes the issue of Thor for this month.
Okay.
So Walter Simonson comes up again, and I'm a big fan of Walter Simonson. I will buy anything with his name on it. I will buy things I'm not interested in. I bought, like, Robocop versus Terminator because okay. he drew it.
Okay.
You know, even though I don't care about Robocop, I've never seen the movie.
Mm.
You know, but I love his work, so I will get anything by him. And I think this is perfect work.
Okay.
And you're wrong to give it 3 out of 9, you're not.
Fair enough.
You're never wrong. We're allowed to have fair opinions. Enough. How about the cover?
You're an expert.
Out of... Oh, no, sorry. Next one was characterization.
Okay.
Do you think the characterization works? Did you know what drove the characters, who they were?
Not really. I think my only wise word is, on this subject, is probably the fact that there are too many characters. So...
I mean, you could argue there's too many characters, therefore each character isn't distinct. I did, again, give it 5 out of 5 because I think... the characterization that is there. So the characters she gives characterization to are the members of X Factor, Skids, and Caliban, and Artie and Leech.
Okay.
Everyone else is, maybe even Candy Southern as well.
Mm.
Everyone else is just the people that they're interacting with.
Mm.
But the story is in the heads of the members of X Factor.
Mm.
And within X Factor, it's more like Marvel Girl, Cyclops.
Mm.
And Angel. They're like the three key ones that you're in their heads.
Mm, mm.
And I think she does that so well that I'm able to go, well, the others, they're just background characters. So the fact that you don't know what's driving Erg, or you don't know what's driving Ape, or you don't know what's driving Sabretooth beyond Bloodlust, you know, I think I can still give a 5 for characterization from my point of view.
Okay.
How do you feel? So you said you didn't think it was that good?
Apart from...
because there were too many characters.
Yeah, apart from the love interest story. And the alien-y type boy.
The little kids, yeah. Leech and Arte.
Who was quite explained what their motivations were. I didn't really...
So what would you give it out of 5 for characters?
3.
Oh, he's mean, he's me. This sadly means that I think X Factor, which is my favourite comic of this era, is going to come out with quite a low score.
Oh no.
But that's fine, because, you know, I'm seeing things wrong with it that I didn't see at the time. So let's do the cover next.
Okay.
It's in front of you, what do you think? Walter Simonson drawing Cyclops.
Very sad.
He does look a bit sad. I mean, Cyclops is very, very moody throughout the run of X Factor. You know, that is part of what is happening. And actually, what they end up doing in the storyline is they have to say he's having mental ill health. okay. to explain what he'd done in the previous issues before this team took over.
Okay.
So, I can understand why he looked moody.
Yeah. Colours work quite well.
Yeah, it's very bold colours. Mm. It's very striking. He's used a very sparse inking style. It's very clean.
Mm.
There's not that many lines. It's more about block blanks.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is not necessarily how Walter Simonson draws all the time.
Mm.
I think it's an effective image of Cyclops.
Mm-hmm.
I've given it a 4 out of 5. Now, part of that 4 out of 5, don't know if I'm allowed to do this, but I have. It's my podcast. I'm scoring it.
Fair.
Is for the logo.
Okay.
Now, this is the first appearance of the logo on this issue. It was designed by a guy called Alex J, who was one of the people who at one point shared a studio with Walter Simonson.
Mm.
And he also designed the Thor logo that was on Thor at the time.
Mm.
But this is the first appearance of this logo, and I think that logo, particularly, I should have got one out actually, to compare for you to the original X-Factor logo. Mm. Because the original X-Factor logo is very ho-hum, and this is amazing. And it looks great on this comic.
Mm.
And I think it helps the cover stand out.
Mm.
Because it's very bold, it's very graphic, it goes with the art style. Would you agree with all that?
Yeah, I would.
Let me show you the original. I'm just Googling on my phone as we speak. Just so I can show Irrigale the original X-Factor logo. It'll be very small because it'll be on my phone. Come on, please work, phone. You know. So I'm just going to show you the issue before. So you can see how it looked before. So that's the issue before. That was what the logo was like on the issue before.
Oh, okay.
I'm holding that up. And I think the strength of that...
Yeah.
I think the new corner box image of the angel, that's a new one.
Yeah.
What they always did on X Factor is they just had one of the characters in the corner box.
Mm-hmm.
But previously they were obviously drawn by the old art team. And Walter Simonson has taken over with this issue, so he's drawn that. But I think there's a real... I mean, the cover's actually very good on the previous issue, but
yeah.
I think the logo, the trade dress, the, you know, the corner box image,
yeah.
I think it's all much more... For that, I felt I had to give some points.
Clean.
I probably would have given this a 3 out of 5 for the image of Cyclops.
Mm.
But for the strong colours, the red, yellow and blue...
Mm.
And for the corner box image and the logo...
I'd have called that orange.
I called that... Okay, yeah, it's an orangey red. Tomato red, maybe.
Tomato red.
I gave it a 4 out of 5. What are you going to give it? Have I convinced you to go up in the world?
Yeah, because I feel... I feel like I've been a bit of a grumpy... Grugger. So I'm going to give it a 4.
You're going to give it a 4 as well.
Mm.
So that takes us to 8. So far it's got 3/8 and a 6.5. So that is, can I quickly do some maths? 24, that's 30.5.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're at acceptable in the 80s, and this is the bit where we can take off points.
Mm.
For things that would have seemed acceptable in the 80s that are not quite as acceptable now.
Mm.
A lot of it is kind of racism issues, and
yeah.
There's a lot of uses of characters have names that reference things that maybe don't work today.
Mm.
I suppose things that aren't politically correct.
Mm.
And I know some people could be very judgmental about people going, well, that's not politically correct.
Mm. Mm.
But actually, I think some of this probably should have been problematic in 1986 as well. So I think we need to start with the racial stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
We have Harpo, who's presented as Inuit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they describe him as being Eskimo, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a phrase we try not to use anymore. We try to use the words that First Nation people would use for themselves. So Inuit tends to be a more common word. And obviously he's harpooning people. So it links to the idea of a primitive fisherman.
There's still a brand of ice cream called Eskimo in France.
Is there? Does it still exist? It's still called that?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, good lord. So we've got Harpoon, obviously, is the first one. And you know, a character who shoots people with harpoons, harpoons are a thing. That's not necessarily a bad thing. But the fact that that is the only Inuit character in up to this point in X-Men history is a bad representation. Then we have the character, as I say, he's now known as Grey Crow because they brought him back and he's quite a good character in that way. But the time is called Scalp Hunter.
Okay.
You know, as a name for a Native American character.
Maybe not.
Yeah. We had a character called Tar Baby, who is the sticky character. Now, obviously, Tar is sticky, but apparently Tar Baby is also a slang term for
comes
a black person.
From, I did some Googling.
Did you Google it when I told you it was
a
slang term?
And let me have a look. It's actually from a book by, or it's a short story from the guy who did, Tar Baby is the second of the Uncle Remus stories published in 1881. The same guy who did Uncle Tom's Cabin, I think.
No, I think Uncle Remus is the one from...
Is it not?
That's something else, isn't it?
Oh.
Yeah, Br'er Rabbit.
Oh, okay.
It says.
I thought doll made of tar and top and
turpentine.
Turpentine used by villainous Br'er Fox to entrap. Yeah, so there's a whole section racist interpretation. Although the term Tar Baby is documented as coming from a folk tale of African origin, its modern meaning in America is different. Many consider Tar Baby to be a pejorative term for African Americans.
So yeah, bad idea for a character name. Bad idea for a character name. We also have two characters presented with various forms of learning difficulties.
Yes.
So there is Ape, who, actually less so in this story, but he's called Ape, and he's presented as being a stupid character.
Okay.
Again, not very PC.
No.
And then we have Artie. Now, Artie is one of the heroes of this story, and he's a good character. But Artie is someone who is presented as being, they describe him in the story as autistic, and he's also mute. And I just think there's certain uncomfortable stuff and certain ableism around Artie. And I think there is, and you may disagree with me with this, obviously I'm not disabled. You are a disabled person.
I am.
So you may have different opinions. I know you're very involved in disabled rights. But for me, I think disabled characters in comics whose superhero powers overcome their disability is almost a form of ableism in and of itself.
Yeah.
So he is mute, is one of his things. And he finds it difficult to communicate because of the way he's presented as being autistic. But then he has a superhero power where he can communicate with pictures.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this is, it's kind of like, it's a bit like Daredevil being blind, but he's got extra senses that mean it doesn't matter that he's blind.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Professor X uses a wheelchair, but it's like a super-powered, miraculous wheelchair that floats.
Yeah.
That can do things wheelchairs can't do.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of, people have an adaptive technology or an adaptive power that takes away the disability. So if you were going to do an interesting story about disability and how disabled people are treated, it actually undermines it from the start because they're not really disabled.
Yeah, sort of like, I agree with you. I thought,
I mean, it's less obvious in this particular issue, but I think it's there in the character.
I mean, certainly the point where Thingy sends him off to tell Jean that he really loves her, or whatever, and then he suddenly realises he can't speak, and that I thought was a bit bizarre.
Yeah, and obviously that will lead to... Because I actually went and read on.
Oh, okay.
Because when I was writing my notes, there's a little secret for the world. I tend to read the comic, Irrigal reads it on Marvel Unlimited.
Yeah.
Because I have a Marvel Unlimited subscription and you prefer reading online.
I do.
And I prefer the comic. But when I was writing the script, just for ease, I was doing it on Marvel Unlimited instead. You know, and sometimes you notice things that you miss because it does the panel view.
Yeah.
So sometimes when you're looking at a whole page... Particularly for me, as a fan of Walter Simonson, I'm impressed by the whole page.
Uh-huh.
And I miss things that's in an individual panel.
Mm.
And what I did was I read on. Because I was enjoying it. And on Marvel Unlimited, it just goes to the next issue, then the next issue, then the... And I think I read 3 or 4 issues in a row after I'd finished the writing the notes. And the following issue, and I'd forgotten this when I was reading it, is Artie comes back and he shows them a picture with his mind and they misinterpret.
Oh, okay.
So he shows them a picture of when Angel and Jean were hugging and Candy walked in.
Right.
And obviously Cyclops sees that and thinks it's him saying, I love you, Jean.
Yeah.
Jean kind of doesn't take any notice of it, but it kind of increases the melodrama.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I suppose actually probably having a mute child who can show you pictures is very good for increasing melodrama.
Yeah.
But I think it is uncomfortable. I think there's stuff going on.
Yeah, I thought, like, I mean, I don't think it's...
Not the biggest issue. And actually, at times, they do some good stuff with it.
Yeah.
There is a point later on in the storyline, and I'm talking like 30 issues forward, where they actually all get sent to school.
Right.
And Artie and Leech get sent to a special school.
Okay.
And there is reference to the autism, and there's reference to, you know, that it's a special school that's going to try and meet their needs.
Yeah.
And there's a whole thing about how Artie and Leech can't be separated. And one of the cutest panels in the history of comics by an artist called John Bogdanov, which is just beautiful, which we will get to maybe one day, who knows. But, you know, they do treat it quite well and they do end up in a special school. And in a way, they get written out by staying in the special school.
Yeah.
But they do stories that are set there and they're being...
Yeah.
Treated in a way that gives them agency.
Yeah, though that's not.
And they're alongside other disabled people
who have
agency.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, they're sent away to a boarding school because that's what they do in comics when they don't want the kid characters around anymore. So, talking of acceptable in the 80s, that's basically where we came. I felt I had a lot to take score off. And we say maximum 5 points off. I took 5 points off.
Oh,
wow. I don't know if I was being too harsh. And this is a comic I love, but I can't deny there's things that are issues.
Mm.
And that's quite difficult sometimes when something's got into your soul. You've read it and loved it, but you know there's problematic elements.
You know,
we all get it. You know, there are things, particularly, you know, if you've lived for decades. There will be, you know, films, there'll be TV shows, there'll be books that you've read and loved that have problematic elements.
But then I guess the thing with, the problem is with all of, I mean, as a 12-year-old boy, you wouldn't have seen those problems.
I mean, I definitely, you know, Tar Baby, I didn't get the reference until I heard it on another podcast. Talking about these characters.
Yeah.
I was quite surprised by that.
That
one I wouldn't have got. I'll be honest, the Indigenous people stuff, I didn't notice. I was quite blinded to that.
Yeah.
Which... You know, I just saw it as, oh, okay, yeah, that's normal. It's completely normal for an Indigenous person to call themselves Scalp Hunter and go after white people.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was my own... element, I suppose, racism in me that I think it was so far away from my experience.
I was 12
when I read this.
So,
that wouldn't have occurred to me.
It's sort of like, I think it probably sort of does come down to the old, you know, to the old problem that, you know, that Wagner was a racist, but, you know, sort of, I mean, should we stop Should we stop Disney?
And, you know, there is no doubt to me, these characters, they're not actually created by Louise and Walter Simonson, the Marauders. Mm. They were created by Chris Claremont for an X-Men story.
Mm. Mm.
And they were designed by John Romita Jr., who drew their first, the X-Men story. He was the X-Men artist at the time.
Mm.
So they're not the fault of these people, at least not those like Scout Hunter and Harpoon.
No.
And I don't believe that the people who created those characters were racist.
No.
And I don't think they did it from a racist point of view.
No.
But I think they would have been as lacking in knowledge of that back then as I was, as a reader. Probably even, possibly more so because they were older people.
And also because, as in a lot of art, you're trying to get the you're trying to get the essential through. So you know, so by calling him Scalp, Scalp
Heather, Scalp Hunter,
Scalp Hunter. So you know, it brings up the old, so you know, the old kind, you know, sort of. Sort of kind of John Wayne.
And I mean, what it would have done as well is, in a way, probably for the people making it, is it was a shorthand way of making sure that people didn't miss the fact that he was Native American.
Yeah, sort of like, and now together with the Inuit, together with, sort of because you're, sort of like, sort of distilling, so because all you can do, sort of like, I mean, within this kind of art form that is kind of quite punchy, perhaps, and so you know, within, so you know, within 25 pages, the so you know, sort of, you have to get to the point quite quickly, and by
so you use shorthand, you use cultural shorthand.
I mean, if you were doing, so you know, if you
and I mean, there is something interesting about pages. The fact that this group of villains was to some extent designed to be diverse.
Yeah.
Now, one thing we didn't discuss, because it didn't come up in the story, but it's mentioned in other stories, is that the character of Scrambler, who's very minor, and that he appears, but very minor in this story, he was intended to be Korean, and that's brought up in other stories.
Yeah.
So there was an attempt to make the villains diverse. As well as, I mean, maybe it comes across worse in X Factor than it does in X Men, because X Factor were the original X Men, and they were all white.
So certainly, reading, so you know, the first, or you know, or the first kind of, you know, Wonder Woman's, or the first kind of, so you know, everybody. There was no, so you know, there was no black people or any kind of ethnic.
I don't know about Wonder Woman. Actually, that might have been more. I mean, to be honest, they quite often were ethnic characters in there, but they
were the bad characters, or so you know, they were the bad guys, or so you know, or
quite interesting today. If we talk about Superman today, while you were reading the comic, I was reading an article from a group whose name I can't remember, but I'll put a reference in our. We do a.
Resources.
At our website, we do kind of a resources with some pictures of what we're talking about. So if you go to shouldilovethis.blogspot.com, and I will put a link to this article that I read that was called "Was Superman a Jew?"
Oh, okay.
And it's based upon the fact that the creators of Superman and a lot of that kind of history were Jewish, and the way that the fact that the creators of Superman, the writer in particular, he'd been escaping pogroms, effectively, his family. And then the town that his family were originally from, where he was born, was destroyed by the Nazis. You know, the fact that that feeds into Superman's creation. So actually, you know, there was a certain amount of diversity in the early comics. I think it was more as they became more corporate that that was kind of taken away, and it was made much more waspish. But yeah, you know, the original X-Men are all white, whereas the new X-Men, the lot that has Storm, and it has, you know, I mean, she's really the only diversity herself. But you know, it's got women, it's got people from other countries, they're all basically white. But you know, it was more, so maybe like diverse villains against diverse heroes is less shocking to look at from a 2021 perspective than this story where it's diverse villains against all white heroes. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much of that is feeds into it. But, you know, it's definitely a very 80s comic book in that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, one of the things that's very 80s is that there's a group of villains who are working from the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Which is very, kind of feeds in quite well to a certain 80s, not nostalgia wouldn't be the word, but a certain view of the world in the 80s. Mm. And obviously the clothes that Skids wears is very 80s.
Mm.
With the tiger print leggings and the off-the-shoulder jumper. And she's actually, in this story, quite sadly, a lot of the time Skids is wearing a red beret. She's not wearing her beret in this one. I know. It wasn't raspberry, it was, like, true red. So that is... I took off 5. How many are you taking off?
I'm going to take off...
out of the 5. For the acceptable in the 80s or not acceptable now, really.
4.
You're taking off 4. So we're taking 9 off, which makes this get, oh gosh.
The lowest.
21.5 points, which I think does put it in last place. I didn't actually write down. In previous episodes, I've written down what we'd scored the other ones to help me find it quickly. But I wasn't that wise with this one. So I think it's going to be the lowest score.
Oh, gosh.
Yes, by a long way. Okay, so yeah. X Factor gets 21.5.
That's sad.
It is, because it was still probably my favourite, but it does deserve the scoring down.
What does Mr. Bumble say?
Mr. Bumble says meow. Oh. Okay, so on that bombshell of it being the lowest, at the moment, our number one spot... continues to be Daredevil.
Uh-huh.
Number 2 is Amazing Spider-Man. Number 3, Fantastic Four. And then number 4 is X-Factor.
Uh-huh.
I know I feel ashamed to be giving it a low score. Because it is a personal favourite.
Mm-hmm.
So next episode, I normally reveal what we're going to do next episode. But this time I'm going to give a choice to Irrigale.
Okay.
So your choice, Irrigale, is... we can either continue this storyline and read the issue of Thor, which follows on directly from this. Yeah. So it shows you what happens next.
Okay.
Or we can skip over and do another Spider-Man book, Weather Spider-Man, which is set in the UK and Northern Ireland.
Weather Spider-Man.
So we're going to do Weather Spider-Man number 20 next issue. Which is quite an interesting comic book and lots of controversy around it. So that'll be quite interesting. So we'll see you soon. And the question, should I love this comic? It's quite difficult this time. Because we basically ended up giving it a half score. 20 out of 40.
21, yeah.
So that makes it sound like we shouldn't love this comic. But I do love this comic. Yeah. What do you think? Should I love this comic?
No.
And on that bombshell, we shall see you hopefully in 2 weeks' time.
Thank you
very much. With Web of Spider-Man number 20. Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
In X-Men 135, I can't actually read what I've written, darling, if you sit on me. Yes, Mr. Bumble. Mr. Bumble is joining us.
He's making himself.
A nuisance.
A nuisance.
Shall I try again?